Hi everyone, I'm Josh, and this is The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens, the podcast where we explore an ever-changing world and our lives in it through the lens of myth, story, and imagination. The Emerald, all that's happening on this green jewel in space. Imagine this. 82,000 years ago, on what is now the Moroccan coastline, someone sat on a beach, gathering shells. Think of it. Here in this world, situated in a vast spiraling arm of stars, in the midst of great spiraling necklaces of time, someone, a small girl perhaps, sat collecting shells. Little whelk shells which themselves grow in spirals. So there by the spiraling sea, within the great spiral of time, she held a single shell between her thumb and forefinger and punctured it with a sharpened stone and strung it with others on a little string of hide and placed that beaded string around her neck. In an act so simple, all it could be is inherent, innate, a reflection of a universe that itself adorns in endless necklaces of spirals. For human beings, adorn. The oldest adornments go back how far? Keeps getting older and older, right? Now they're saying 160,000 years. The earliest graves we know of are adorned with flowers and beads. Bodies draped in jade, sprinkled in jasper, ringed in bone, scattered in shell, powdered in ochre. A scarab pendant adorns the heart of the pharaoh. Tattoos adorn the flaking skin of ice mummies. Bodies everywhere across all time are dotted, strung, emblazoned with shiny things. Quote, anything that shimmers holds a special attraction for us. This fascination is as old as human existence, says Kathleen Martin. In the earliest burial sites, we find iridescent shells, red powder, animal teeth or bones, all offering some special magic. Special magic. Stones, beads, shells. Three types of perforated shells have been found at the Franchthi cave in what today is Greece, dating back 36,000 years. And then 30,000 years later, at this very same cave, they were still perforating the same three types of shells. 30,000 years of continuity. 1,000 generations like beads on a string. A string of ancestry, a string of focus, a string of ritual, a string of beauty, a rosary of time. Every single culture that has ever adorned the planet itself adorns. We adorn in feathers, we adorn in bone and in shell, we adorn in patterned cloth, we puncture ears and set them with gold. We adorn brides and grooms and acolytes and initiates and prom queens and athletes, and we pin medals to the lapels of military officers. We adorn. Our visions of the world are adorned. Culture itself, you could say, is an adornment. The dances we dance, the songs we sing, the chants we chant, the patterns we weave, the initiatory rites we hold. Why do any of it? It's an adornment, a repetitive woven pattern, a reflection of a world adorned. So deeply embedded is our need to adorn that even those traditions that have deliberately removed themselves from adornment, monastic traditions who cast away all attachment to the adornments of life, did so as a reaction to the universality of adornment. And then, who knows, perhaps they found that even those monks' robes, those single bowls, those ascetic clothes, those simple Rudraksha rosaries were themselves adornments. And even those who chose to walk completely naked, completely possessionless, were themselves, as the sages sang, adorned in empty sky. Because this universe itself unfolds in limitless spirals of adornment. Of what are the adornments of the universe? Of what are her necklaces? She is draped in galaxies that are draped in worlds, that are draped in ranges, that are draped in forests, that are draped in branches, that are draped in needles, that are draped in infinite necklaces of December frost. Adorned in summer lightning is the goddess Kali, sing the hymns. The mother goddess, they say, wears the whole universe as her ornament. And so she is Shakti, adorned in receding veils of waterfall mist and electric blue birds of paradise, adorned in antlers, adorned in spiraling horns, adorned in glistening eyes. You, great goddess, adorned in abalone and claws, adorned in an ever-entwining mantle of roots and vines, adorned in the necklace garland of all the songs that sing of you, and all other songs besides. Adorned in life, adorned in death, adorned in time. Why did our ancestors adorn? Perhaps to adorn is the simplest way to align to an adorned world, an affirmation of how things are in nature all around us, in a world decorated, graced with the delicate latticework of the weaver spider and the intricate spiral of fingertip whorls. To adorn is to align to a greater pattern, to a rhythm, to connect to a great arrangement, the symphonic arrangement of creation. Woven, loomed, deliberate. To adorn is to bring to life a delicate patterned geometry that is present in the golden Fibonacci geometry of creation all around us. So in Western India, the embroidered patterns mirror the jagged lines of the date palm frond. In the Amazon, the patterns woven in fabric and the patterns painted on bodies are reflections of the patterns of creation, all of which live on the body of the ancestral world serpent. The whale tails and fish scales and Polynesian tattoos mirror nature's patterns, even as they call protectors and keep unwanted energies out. In this day and age, we equate adornment primarily with a display of aesthetic beauty, wealth, and status. But this is not traditionally why people adorned. Adornment is communication, story, identity, and it is more, much more even than this. When our Paleolithic ancestors assumed the boar tusk mask or the feathered crown, why was it? Why do we wear necklaces close to the heart? Why do we specifically adorn eyes and ears? Why the neck? Let's get into the deep somatics of it. First are the obvious somatics. How do we say this? There are places on the body that protrude, that stick out, both visually and structurally. And these prominent features on the body are places of both vulnerability and sensitivity. The eyes are sensitive. The ears are sensitive. What did our ancestors require of their ears? Our ancestors' ears needed to be open to the slightest sounds in the forest. They needed to be tuned to a deep forest hearing. And they also needed to be guarded at all costs. Sense organs needed to be both protected and enhanced. For sense organs, you could say, are our built-in adornments. The shiny eyes, the delicate spiraling ears, the glistening tongue, they are precious. They must be guarded and opened. To adorn is to enhance and to protect at once. It's no accident that some of our earliest adornments were made of animal horns. For what are horns? Horns are sense organs. The narwhal feels through its 12-foot spiral horn. The wild boar feels through its tusks. The elk's antlers are antennae. So horns are the sense faculties of the animal that in humans are often lacking. And horns are also defensive. They guard, they protect. The tusk of the boar is for sensing and defending at once. The shiny place is the sensitive place and the defensive place at once. So our ancestors placed horn on their heads, both to feel more deeply and to protect. Quote, priests, priestesses, or shamans of ancient societies would take on the power of an animal by wearing a necklace made of its teeth, bone, or feathers. And not just take on the power in an abstract, symbolic way. To assume the sense faculties of the animal being by becoming it, by directly taking on its shining, flashing, delicate, sensate horns and teeth and fur and feathers. So the plumage of the macaw becomes the vehicle through which the Amazonian seer flies. The antlers become antennae through which the seer sees and hears. Our ancestors adorn themselves to change consciousness. And not just to change it, to arrange it, so that consciousness itself becomes more patterned, more cohesive. To enhance consciousness as a patterned field of shining points through which to sense, feel, defend, absorb, deflect, to exist in patterned relation. To adorn is to construct consciousness. To arrange a consciousness that is patterned in alignment to the pattern of nature. For what constructs consciousness more than focus? Traditionally, to acquire or create an adornment took time. To collect the shells, perforate each one, coil a string from plant fibers or animal hide, this all took focus, patience, deliberate aesthetic. All the skills that help forge a well-patterned consciousness. The bear claw necklace was not simply something that looked fierce. The bear claw necklace was ordeal after ordeal. It was hours upon hours of focus. It was breath and sweat and rapture and a willingness to dwell on the precarious edge. And that type of focus itself is an adornment of consciousness. The consciousness that knows careful, deliberate focus over time itself becomes adorned. But in an age in which adornments can be bought with a single click, and all the time and focus is outsourced to Etsy creators and high-end jewelers and indentured gold miners, adornment has lost much of its meaning. In an age in which everything has been extracted from context and superficialized, adornment, like everything else, can become just about the superficial bling, and what once was a vehicle through which to construct the slow, deliberate patterning of consciousness in alignment with the powers of nature becomes a way to indulge the most impulsive aspects of consciousness, to temporarily satiate that which addictively craves the immediate fix of the shiny and bright. So on one end of the spectrum, adornment becomes a flagrant display, sometimes veering into the realm of the repulsive. Like, how hollow does it ring when Hollywood divas, adorned in millions of dollars of questionably procured diamonds, ask you to support their liberal cause du jour? Can anyone really justify wearing $3 million worth of ice to the Oscars when just up the street there are people without beds, walls, or food? I don't think so. But on the other side of the equation, the assumption that all that shines, that all that is accumulated, that all that is carefully beaded and strung and woven and hammered is a distraction, this can have its consequences too. For in this world of raw materiality, how we construct pattern, how we find focus, how we decorate, how we enhance, how we shield and guard, how we adorn, is important. It's a reflection of our commitment to life. The world itself is adornment. So you could say how we interact with adornment is how we interact with the world. The process of procuring something gradually and deliberately, and tending to it, and cultivating a deep relationship with it, and infusing it with song and story, and weaving for it a place to be held, and counting it as an ally over time, and finding through it a larger alignment and a greater guardianship and a deeper sensory wakefulness and an enhanced sense of preciousness of place and object and being can be a balm, a medicine for fractured minds in a fractured world. So tell me, of what are your adornments? In a world of vast forces and uncertain paths, what is the stone or the file of light that you clutch at your heart to see your way through dark caverns? Of what are they wrought, the lockets and keys that you hold close, the talismans and amulets? Are they the psychic guardianships you have acquired through repetitive ritual? Are they the supportive powers of community? Are they your true heart friends, you know, the real friends? Are you necklaced with the simple meditative focus you've cultivated from hours on the cushion or the mat? Are you ringed in the simplicity of solid choices? What are your adornments, daughter of the river? What will you take with you on your journeys through underworlds and upper worlds and birthing spaces and battles and places of joy and trial and dark and light? Of what are your adornments, son of wonder? Of what raw matter are they hewn? Are they of gold or of silver? Of community, of culture? Of bone and ash and time? Are you necklaced in all that life experience? Are you tattooed in temporal reality? Are you crowned with all the wild beings and songs and practices to which you have apprenticed? In tantric tradition, songs and sounds and animate beings were, over time, installed on the body of the individual as ornaments. Can you feel into that slow, deliberate process, that humming alchemy? What can you truly claim as your ornaments? For it is one thing to hear a song, another to sing it, another to know it, another for it to take its place on your rosary of wild and living powers. Yes, it is another thing to be bespangled in songs acquired on deep journeys. Who knows, for that song to become one of your ornaments may require singing it 10,000 times. For that song to become a bead on your necklace of guardianship and wonder may require crying it out as if it was the last song you were to ever sing. It may require going to the very edge of the world, to the place where all the songs live. So tell me, bright starling, in what powers of the world are you bangled? In an adorned universe, how do you yourself adorn? Let us count the ways, shell by shell, bead by bead, one talisman at a time. Universe adorned, ornament in culture, cosmos, and consciousness, this time on the Emerald. If you ever happen upon a magpie's nest, you may find that it is full of shiny things. Buttons and pins, lost necklaces, glass eyes, perhaps an emerald, who knows. It seems that those dappled birds can't get enough of the bright stuff. So magpie syndrome, as it is sometimes called, is to be drawn to bright, shiny objects. And most humans are really just magpies in disguise. Yes, we like our shiny things. Just ask, you know, that psychedelic crab from Moana.
I'd rather be shiny like a treasure from a sunken pirate wreck. Scrub the deck and make it look shiny. I will sparkle like a wealthy woman's neck. Just a sec, don't you know?
Just think of how many words we have for shine. sparkle, spangle, glow, glisten, radiate, dazzle, scintillate, illuminate, glitter, shimmer, glimmer, gleam. We speak of phosphorescence, fluorescence, luminescence, pearlescence. We all know the brilliance of the Photurus lucicrescens, the common summer firefly. Why such a proclivity towards the shine? Scientists have recently linked it to an attraction to water, an instinctive draw towards that which we depend upon for life itself. But after examining the science behind those particular studies, I feel they leave something missing in the explanation. It's even more primal than that. We are attracted to shine because our very bodies are constructed in relation to luminosity. Our hormonal and neurological flows, our pulses, our tides, are constructed around light cycles, the light cycles of the sun and the moon. So we are somatically drawn to shine as we are drawn to source itself. We are drawn to shine because the natural world which birthed us shines. To be drawn towards a luminous focal point is to be drawn towards what Jacob Bohm called the secret heart of nature. The distant river and the late afternoon sun, the flashing eye of the hunted ibex, the blaze of the sacrifice fire, the flash of the belly of the fish inviting the spear with the promise of food, the moon that governs all of this, the stars which hold all stories forever. All these are what we are woven of. All these shine. That which shines is nature herself shining. Experiences of conjunctive rapture shine. There is a reason the mead of poets is described as pearlescent, and the nectar of trance shines like light through honey, and the Sanskrit texts have dozens of words for experiences of illumination. And in those states of heightened consciousness, that which shines takes on special meaning. It imprints, it leads us, it invites us into its patterned heart. So gems and shells and pearls and things that shine seem to be a bridge from a mundane world to a deeper world. To stare into a gem or jewel is to stare into the cosmos itself, into the heart of the universe. Why are there so many colors? Kevin Garnett asks Adam Sandler as he stares into an opal in the 2019 movie Uncut Gems.
Why's it got so many colors in it, man? What is this?
That's the thing. They say you can see the whole universe in opals. That's how f***ing old they are.
Holy shit.
I've been telling you. That's what I want you to see.
Your
app's crazy.
Ornament, says Oleg Graybar, serves to transport us from the mundane to the eternal, to the fundamental pattern of creation, to the divine. We recognize in ornament a dazzling symmetry of creation. We experience, as Abhinavagupta called it, chamatkara, the bliss of aesthetic. And this world, make no mistake, is an aesthetic world. This world is ornament. There's a reason Vedacharya Stanisvar Tamalsina told me in a recent conversation that tantric visionaries devoted a huge amount of time commenting on the aesthetics of dance and poetry. You know, 500 plus page treatises on poetic ornamentation. It's because ornament is the pattern of creation itself. Ornament is what makes music music. Take out the ornament, the trills and glissades and vibrato and mordants and appoggiaturas, and what is left? The music is realized and fulfilled through ornament. Ornament is what makes poetry poetic. Ornament is the very stuff of creation, the pattern of life. So, ornament in some traditions is the great goddess herself. She is known through ornament. She is known through all the ways she shines and vibrates and hums and trills and glides. And of course, the trap is when we focus only on the fleeting shine of ornament and not on the eternal pattern to which it leads. The problem comes when we view the material shine as an end unto itself. And in this world of fleeting shine, We have gone literally crazy for the shiny stuff. Wars have been fought for the shiny stuff. Lives upended, kingdoms overthrown, innocents murdered for single stones. In The General History of the Things of New Spain, quote, Fray Bernardino de Sahagún relates the Aztecs' astonishment at the Spaniards' lust for gold. The Spaniards, he says, seized upon the gold like monkeys, their faces flushed, for clearly their thirst for gold was insatiable. They starved for it, they lusted for it. They wanted to stuff themselves with it as if they were pigs. They went about handling the streamers of gold, passing them back and forth, grabbing them one to the other, babbling, talking gibberish amongst themselves. Cortez even told the Aztecs that he and his men suffered from a disease of the heart, which is only cured by gold. And it seems very little has changed. We are as obsessed as ever with external shine. Pop culture is bedecked in bling, always has been. In a world of fleeting loyalties and dubious intentions, Marilyn Monroe crooned, diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Tiffany's.
And Rihanna encourages us to
shine bright like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond.
And hip-hop, of course, is dripping with gold and diamonds, saturated in bling.
Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling.
I got your budget on my neck, your deal on my wrist, your whole entire life savings on my picket.
Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling. Bling, 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 bling.
Gold all in my chain. Gold all in my ring. Gold all in my watch. Don't believe me, just watch. Gold all in my chain. Gold all in my ring. Gold all in my watch. Don't believe me, just watch.
This attraction to bling is not new. The myths themselves are teeming with shiny things. The Celtic tales give us pearl-rimmed cauldrons, necklaces, gauntlets, amulets, talismans. The Finnish Kalevala drips with rings. In many traditional visions, the gods themselves shine as gold. Throughout the Indo-European mythic world, says M.L. West, the gods are gold-limbed, gold-adorned, gold-armored, golden-helmed, gold-winged. Dionysus is golden. Indra and the Maruts are golden. The goad of Zeus is golden. The horses of Poseidon are gold-maned. All through history, cultures have described the forces of nature as golden. And they're not wrong. This world is, in fact, luminous. So the work of the individual practitioner involves finding alignment to that true gold, the true shine of nature, rather than the ephemerality of material gold. Our gold is not vulgar gold, declared the alchemists. For the true shine is that which is eternal, the secret heart of nature, the pattern of creation. There is a deeper gold that this universe reveals, a deeper treasure, a deeper shine. And perhaps the longing for gold ultimately is a longing for that which shines eternal. And adornment, in its most aligned expression, is a reflection of the pattern of nature itself. Let's go deeper into this. Let's look for a moment at the word adorn and ornament. The or in adorn and ornament is the same or in order. It means arranged in a pattern. That which is adorned is that which is arranged in a pattern. Even the word cosmetics, a word now associated with the $48 billion a year cosmetics industry, derives from the same Greek root as cosmos. Cosmos, arranged in order. Cosmetic means reflective of the cosmos. So linguistically, to adorn is to arrange in order, and to reflect a larger order of the cosmos. The cosmos, this universe, is intricately arranged, intricately ordered, jeweled and necklaced, necklaced in nebulae, adorned in gravity, which makes beads out of everything. Did you hear? Gravity makes shining beads out of everything. Gravity is a great jeweler. The sun, the moon, the worlds, all beads suspended on the fathomless black throat of space. The laws of physics, one could say, are adornments. Nuclear and thermodynamic forces that create ripples, patterns, fields that are woven with spiraling strings, punctuated with bright nuclei, a garment of mirrors, an infinite net of jewels. And the whole universe is strung on me, says Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, like pearls on a string.
Matta parataram nanyat kinchidasti dhananjaya mayi sarvamidam protam sutre manigana iva.
In a universe adorned in such forces, it's no wonder that the ancients sang of adornment as the very nature of the universe. The manifest world is adornment itself, the early Vedas say. All the works of creation were fashioned by Devastar, the shaper, the craftsman who gave shape to lightning, to Indra's thunderbolt, to the drinking cup of the immortal nectar, and who is also, quote, the shaper of all human and animal forms, who develops the embryo in the womb. In the ascetic tales, quote, there figures repeatedly a divine artificer, Kordalagon, who makes things in his heavenly smithy, a cradle for the newborn Soslan, armor, weapons, a plow, a flute that plays melodies by itself. Yes, this universe is an artist, a seamstress, a weaver, a smith, forging flutes that play of themselves, resounding forever in echoing layers of scintillant ornament. Quote, Latvian songs refer to a celestial smith working at his forge in the heavens, or sometimes in or beside the sea. At dawn, the sparks fly, the cinders fall to earth. He is making a crown for his sister, a crown, a golden belt, or a ring for the daughter of the sun. A golden belt for the daughter of the sun. This world in many visions is the mother goddess adorned. In fact, one of the ancient Egyptian names for the goddess was the necklace. Goddess Hathor was referred to as the necklace or the collar. The goddess is the necklace of the universe. And the necklace of Hathor transmitted vital life force. For what is life force but a vibrant adornment on the body of space? Quote, the circular necklace indicates the underlying unity of her world, while the many beads, pearls, or chains represent the multiplicity and diversity of manifest life. The multiplicity and diversity of manifest life, the beaded string, the garland of primal patterns that express in the spirals of nature all around us. In one tantric vision, the mother goddess is named Malini, the garland. The garland of what? The garland of vibrational energies that is the universe. The garland of matter, the garland of light, the garland of electrons, the garland of galaxies, the garland of sounds, the garland of songs. The garland of waters, the garland of all the flowering plants and all the coiling vines. In one group of Amazonian languages, the word for adornments and the word for medicinal plants is the same. Adornment refers to the patterns through which the universe is created, the patterns of beads and paint and feathers that people wear, the powers of these patterns, and the medicinal plants that are associated with each of these powers. Everything is evaluated through the lens of pattern and adornment, because adornment is the vehicle through which the power manifests. The powers are plants. The powers are songs. The power is pattern. In the Taoist vision, David Hinton tells us, the Tao, the existence tissue, as he calls it, creates itself, decorates itself, celebrates itself. Quote, the existence tissue decorates itself with identity and meaning, just as it decorates itself with ridgelines and sea mist, with rainbows and with cities. Existence, the mother goddess herself, is known through her adornments. How shall we know her? We shall know her through her garland of songs and patterns and plants. And this is why, quite often, the mother goddess's ornaments are described in far more detail than she herself is. When Asclepius's Lucius has a vision of the great mother goddess Isis, it is a vision first and foremost of her adornments. A wreath of flowers, a circlet like the moon, a robe of shimmering stars, a sky mantle, a three-pronged rattle that rings and shakes. The Virgin Mary is similarly described in terms of her mantle, her blue mantle of stars, adorned in the vast depths of sky. Yes, the raiment of the goddess is sky and stars and dawn. The goddess Ushas, says the Rig Veda, dresses splendidly, like a girl on her way to a festival. Her face, it says, turns to all things across this wide world, as she rises in splendor, enwrapped in bright clothes, shining in golden colors, dressed in rays of light. She guides forth the day, like a cow leads her calves. Like lightning in the sky shines her crown, invokes the Chandipataha, the great hymn to the goddess Durga. And when Durga emerges, she is adorned in all the powers of the universe. Quote, the serpent within the great ocean of milk gave her a crystal necklace and a crest jewel. The gods gave her garments that do not fade, a pair of earrings, a set of bangles, stainless bracelets for her arms, stainless anklets, bejeweled rings for all her fingers. Thus adorned, cries the text, the goddess repeatedly roared and laughed to the sky, which was torn open with her cries. The goddess shines, radiates, scintillates, gleams. Her anklets ring, her earrings flash. The brightness sears itself into the open eyes of her devotees in ecstasy. They name in song each of her ornaments one by one, over and over. So the morning recollection of Durga calls out, quote, I remember you, goddess, the highest divinity in the morning with the glow of the rays of the autumn moon, adorned with beads, and with earrings shaped as crocodiles and decorated with gems, having 1,000 arms shining blue, each distinguished with divine weapons. I bow to you, Chandi, in the morning, you of infinite forms. Have you seen her, her of infinite forms, adorned in crocodiles, adorned in the blue arms of the sky? The universe is known through her adornments, her attributes, her aspects, her periodic table of powers. People often ask why Hindu deities come with so much bling, so much accoutrement, so much ornament. You know, so many arms, so many bangles, bracelets, bells, necklaces, crowns, earrings, anklets. Each one is a power, an attribute of nature, an attribute of the cosmos, an attribute of consciousness. How many attributes does nature have? How many serpentine powers? How many bright powers? How many varieties of quartz? How many species of songbird? How many symphonies on how many bright electric strings? How much space dust? How many comets? How many blazing atoms stitched and strung together to form the bridal veil of infinite space? Each adornment, each power, each attribute is an aspect of the great pattern of nature, the dynamism of nature, Nature, which shimmers like gold, pierces like an arrow, rings out in infinite bells. Each blade of summer grass, a bell. Each crystal of winter frost, a bell. Nature, nature, she blazes in her tongue rings of fire, reverberates like a spiraling conch that spans the sky. Of what are her adornments? Of what is her crown? Great mystery, of what is your crown? And she responds, crowned in the spirals of the great hawk's flight, crowned in all the shades of the coming night, crowned in an eternal circlet of chime, crowned in time, crowned in time. Her bells ring with the high, clear vibration of consciousness itself. Her earrings stir the primal vibratory power of the universe awake. Her feet pound on the infinite void. Her anklets shake with Spanda Shakti. Do you hear? Her anklets shake. The sweet bells of creation ring out again like nectar in the void. The cycle of creation begins again. A universe leaps into being again, strung with joy and pain. A rosary of lovers' moans and infants' cries. A garland of stars and sweat and blood and tears. Who is this transcendent woman, Ramprasad invoked, striding across the heart of absolute reality? Her sublime form, darker than the darkest thundercloud, streams with all the blood ever shed. Drops of perspiration adorn her body, pearls rolling across a sapphire mirror. Her beauty is enthralling, annihilating. Tangled strands of her hair flow wildly like the blackness of the breaking storm. Yes, she is not only adorned in gold and pearls, but also in blood, in sweat, in skulls, in heads, in hands. We've all seen the images of the fierce goddesses garlanded in severed heads. Why? Because Mother Nature is the full cycle of life and death. If the whole universe is her adornment, then death is her adornment as much as life is. Thou hast cast away thy necklace of jewels, Mother, sang Ramprasad, and worn instead a garland of human heads. So she wears all the signs of death as her ornaments. Ash, bone, corpses as earrings, venomous snakes round her wrist. She is garlanded in the totality of nature, a totality which includes death, nothingness, extinction. It's hard to swallow in the times that we're in, but extinction, too, is one of the adornments of nature. Stanisław Timocina draws a distinction between visions of the bright, radiant goddesses adorned in gold and jewels and the dark, absorptive goddesses adorned in ash and nothingness. Quote, these broad commonalities can be interpreted in terms of emanation and reabsorption. The deities of emanation wear beautiful garments, while the deities depicting reabsorption wear almost nothing, or chopped hands and snakes. Together, this pulse is the universe. Emptiness and fullness, death and life, a universe adorned equally in rot and sprout, in ash and jewels. All this is her adornment. Time and space themselves are her adornments. Which raises the question, if she is adorned in time and space, if those are her adornments, who is she? If she is adorned in eternity itself, then who is she? Who is she? Draped in the two-sided garment of existence and non-existence, crowned with infinity, bangled in temporal reality, bedecked in multiplicity? If her adornments are all this, then of what is her great mystery body underneath? Of what unfathomable mother power is your body of mystery? To draw near to that is to enter into a holiness that words can never touch. It is to enter into astonishment. Do you hear? The mother power is astonishing. She, the infinite adorned mother of the cosmos, is astonishing. Her ringing ornaments astonish the three worlds. The morning sun makes fire of the flicker's tail. Do you hear? She is speckled, dotted, strung in strands of blazing energy. Do you hear? The goddess Inanna, the Sumerian texts say, is adorned in awe. The astonished awe with which we behold her, that too is one of her adornments. She is adorned in the awe of all that behold her, adorned in rising neck hairs and widened eyes of ecstasy. Imagine a necklace made of all the shivers of awe, animal awe, ancestral awe, warrior awe, ecstatic awe, all the shivers of awe that have ever swept across the sentient skin of the world, adorned in the awe of all that behold her.
Adorned in the awe of all that behold her.
Scintillant light of the flicker's tail.
Scintillant light of the flicker's tail.
Singing in awe of the light that surrounds her.
Singing in awe of the light that surrounds her.
Tell me, who is the one who stitched your veil?
Tell me, who is the one who stitched your veil? Tell me, how deep is your veil? Adorned in the awe of all that behold you, scintillant light of the flicker's tail. Singing in awe of the light that surrounds you. Tell me, who is the one who stitched your veil? Tell me, who is the one who stitched your veil? Tell me, how deep is your veil?
So these descriptions of universal adornment, of the goddess adorned, are what? Poetic, beautiful, powerful metaphors? But they are more than this. So central is adornment, for example, to the tantric vision of the universe and of consciousness, that in hymns like the Sundariya Lahari, ornaments are named one by one, meticulously, deliberately. The names of each ornament are sung aloud over and over again. In tantric practices of visual architecting, visualization practices like they're sometimes called, every single ornament is visualized in deep detail. Every earring, every headpiece, every bangle, every bracelet, every bone apron, every tinkling anklet. Why? Why is there so much emphasis on deities' adornments? Of what benefit is it to visualize in perfect, shining, humming detail necklaces and crowns? Of what benefit is it to hear the tinkling of anklets, to utter a specific seed syllable for each shining ornament? Clearly, the ornaments have a deeper significance than simply embellishment for the sake of embellishment, right? The hands and gestures, the heads and seats, the ornaments and garments of the deities, says Tim Alsina, mean something. And more than that, they are something. And this gets at something so central to the tantric vision and the animate vision. The point is not simply to see the adornments as poetic metaphors. On the one hand, these images mean something, Tim Alsina says, and thus are the referents, and on the other hand, they are also the sign holders. What does that mean? It means the ornaments are the energies themselves. They are uttered syllables, they are animate beings, they are the living permutations of animate consciousness in all its detailed glory. So that in practice, to invoke and visualize and assume the adornments is to shape and architect consciousness itself. There's something here about depth and thoroughness, about consciousness not being simply amorphous, but also how consciousness can be architected in humming, vibrant detail, and how to do so is a reflection of the depth and specificity and harmony of the world around us. Look at this ornamented world. Look at the detail, the spiral ornament of the snail shell, the lacework of the DNA strand, the radiant filament of the quark and gluon. Energy is specific in how it manifests. It's not vague at all. So the more thoroughly the adornments are felt, the more articulated the adornments, the more detailed the adornments, the more vibrational depth consciousness has. Do I have a vague notion of the Mother Goddess, a vague notion of the animate energy? Or do I see her in resplendent detail, dripping with pearls on her body of dark sapphire? Do I have a sense of some vague, animate presence that lives nearby, over there by the river somewhere? Or do I see it bearded in willow branches, with eyes of knotted bark, calling with a creaking voice of wind, draped in ornaments of leaf and lichen and squirrel bone? Do I invoke the animal power as a symbolic gesture? Or do I drape myself in fur and horns? And do those horns become bright points of focus through which to align to the greater world more acutely? If we want a deeper relationship with the animate world around us, perhaps we need to cultivate more depth of detail. A song, for example, is not a haphazard, amorphous thing. A song is precise in its harmonies and its ornamentation. The animate energies around us are not haphazard, random, unformed. The animate energies around us have all the intricacy and detail and personality of songs, of persons adorned in scintillating detail. So the detail of the tantric vision is staggering. The Tibetan tantras offer intricate, radiant depictions of deity mandalas. Each deity, each mandala adorned. Each garment, each earring, each skull cup in its right harmonic place. Vajra Varahi, the fierce goddess of consciousness in the tantric Buddhist vision, is resplendent in her adornments of bone. Her blood-red undulant form is offset with stark white bone ornaments. As it says in the Abhisa Mayamanjari, she is beautified by a set of 5 tantric ornaments, all made of human bone. She wears an ornate forehead band with a row of 5 human skulls and jewels. Her hair tie has come adrift, leaving her hair loose and disordered. She reveals her passionate and abandoned nature through her exultant nakedness. Her blood-red color, her hair which flies loose in defiance of socio-sexual constraint. She is tantalizing, overcome with longing. She laughs with her mouth open, her body horripilating. She wears a garland of heads, 50 in number, corresponding to the 50 vowels and consonants. Her other mudras are also of human bone. There are earrings, a necklace, an armlet on the upper arm, a wrist bracelet. There are anklets, which Umapati Deva says are tinkling. Her waist belt is particularly ornate. Adorned with bone and pearl, it swings upon the goddess's hips. In rapturous practice to assume the form of the goddess in such detail, to feel the bone ornaments on the body, to feel bone right at the brow, the stark eternity of death right at the forehead and the crown, to feel the bone apron swinging on the hips, the pulse of life, the sway of the hips contrasted with the stark ringing of white bone. This is to directly architect consciousness. To put on the imaginal ornaments is to enhance consciousness, and each ornament corresponds to a particular rapturous state. So the ornaments are not metaphors for other things. They are felt within the consciousness of the practitioner. Over time, they become enhancements of consciousness. Enhancing the practitioner's ability to perceive, to defend, they become an aesthetic construct, a garment, a mandala, a citadel of consciousness, sensitive, awake, adorned, animate, alive. The ornaments wake up the senses, the feeling body, the faculties of cognition. They are bright, flashing gold, iridescent moon-like pearl, diaphanous, piercing, lustrous, milky white, medicinal. They are all the textures of awakened trance consciousness. And they don't just flash and shine and resplend. They ring with sound. Bone clatters and rattles, gold shimmers, anklets sparkle like tiny bells, the ornaments of the goddess chime, they reverberate with vibration. In one astonishing verse from the Sundari Lahari, goddess Saraswati hears the flow of the goddess Tripura Sundari's speech and responds by nodding her head. The whole cosmos nods in agreement. And as she nods, her earrings clang with the sound Om. Omkara, Omkara.
Saraswatya Suktiramrita Lahari Kaushala Hari Pibantya Sharvani Shravana Chulukabhyama Viralam Chamatkara Shlagha चलित शिरस कुंडल गणो झणत्कारे स्तारे प्रतिवचन माचष्ट इवते.
So the bard sings, the speech of the universe flows through the singer practitioner, and the universe hears the sound of itself singing in infinite layers of reverberating voice. The singer sings and the universe nods in agreement in a pulse of divine resonance, and all the adornments of the world sing along, reverberating with the seed sound of creation itself, like a morning, perhaps, of impossible blue skies and winter frost in the sunlight. A morning when you sang aloud to a frost-covered world, and it seemed every hexagonal frost crystal sang back like a bell. And the rolling creek water played the hanging icicles like gongs, and all the adornments of all the world were singing. Do you hear? The ornaments remind us that the bright vibrational matrix of creation, this world of icicles and creek water, is utterly glorious. Aesthetic gloriousness sounding its own glory forever. So the adornments are made of sound. The goddess is draped in bright, ornamented sound, and the practitioner adorns their own body in rosaries of uttered sound. As the sound is repeated over and over, the ornament is invoked over and over, it adorns the consciousness. Mantras repeated adorn. A rosary is what? A string of beads and something you say aloud. It is both. It is sound and ornament at once. The singer who invokes the armor of the goddess Durga seals, protects, guards, and awakens the senses and sense faculties with an imaginal armor of sounds installed upon the body. The sounds both awaken and they protect. The conch with its spiraling vibrational resonance becomes armor for the ears, a humming conch, a humming shell for your ears, beloved, a necklace to protect your speech, a jewel at the crown to keep your thoughts focused and clear. Adorned, the consciousness brightens into a network, a latticework garment, a mantle of bright points. The adornments wake the senses, so that, as E.E. Cummings said, now the ears of my ears are awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. Are the ears of the ears awake? Have the eyes of the eyes been opened? Can you feel the hundreds of thousands of years of continuity, the Paleolithic ancestral continuity, an unbroken lineage that extends from Paleolithic assumption of ornaments of horn and bone to the imaginal bone apron of the Tantrika, to the armor of God and Christian tradition? Archaeologists in Finland recently uncovered a 5,000-year-old apron adorned in dozens upon dozens of elk teeth. Such adorned aprons are still in use by Siberian shamans, says Karina Solovyova of the Russian Museum of Ethnography. Siberian shamans wear adorned aprons that are completed gradually over years and years and years. Pendants representing helper spirits, she says, are gradually attached according to the shaman's instructions. The adornments are made of metal and bone and are, quote, of zoomorphic and anthropomorphic types. Beasts, birds, human souls, mother beasts in the image of a female moose and a loon guide, images of shamans' ancestors, models of arrows, knives, mirrors, and small bells are also used to protect against evil spirits. These adornments are fed with ritual foods, such as blood, and asked for advice during kamlanie, or ceremony. As the shaman becomes more powerful, the number of pendants on the apron increases. By putting on the adorned ritual garment, the shaman acquires additional power and vision, can perform ceremony, and can go on journeys through the worlds of the universe. Arrows, knives, mirrors, and bells. The sound and the shine and the embedded story facilitate rapturous travel, and they serve another simultaneous purpose. They defend. Ornament is psycho-spiritual defense. From the earliest times, people have adorned for guardianship, to protect, to defend, to guard the individual consciousness, the ritual space, the community, to defend themselves against unwanted stares and roving disruptive energies that might seek to find a way in. The origin of eye makeup as we know it was as a spiritual protectant. Egyptians adorned eyes with kohl to keep the evil eye away. The ring, with its unassailable circular form, guards. The necklace, quote, safeguards the vital link between the head and the rest of the body. A bead or a stone or a cross at the throat safeguards the seat of the voice. Ornament forms a citadel of defense. In far western India, in Kutch, a place very dear to my heart, lives a wellspring of adornment so deep, so beautiful, it's hard to put into words. Every tribe, every village has its own embroidery stitch, its own pattern, its own means of communication and defense, its own bright mirror work. From Charlotte Kwan, quote, the rationale for the use of mirrors is consistent across many tribal communities. They are both auspicious and defensive. Mirrors ward off the evil eye, reflecting it back on the sender. The placement of mirrors in embroidery is very important because of the power they have. Mirrors are placed at the center of designs, as in the nexus of a spider's web. Adornment defends. This is as true for the Polynesian warrior as for the Jat tribeswoman as it is for Gucci Mane. Yes, the oversized coats and thick boots of 90s hip-hop were more than a fashion statement. The grills and chains do more than proclaim status. It's a spiritual defense mechanism. You heard it here first. Why do so many cultures put such emphasis on defense? At a time of increasing interest in animism and animist practice, this is interesting to look at. It's always worth looking at what gets left out in the modern adoption of animist practice. Because often what gets left out happens to be foundational and essential. So for example, guardianship, defense, spiritual protection. These are utterly essential foundations of traditional animist practice. Traditional animist practice places a huge emphasis on guardianship. Guardian entities are known, familiar, thoroughly interacted with. They are fed, called to, asked for assistance. They adorn the very bodies of the trance practitioner. Why would you walk in a precarious world unadorned? Why would you not carry the deep relationships and protections that you have forged with you? Modern reclamations of animism tend to skip over the whole guardianship part because it can easily be seen as superstitious, right? But as a result, you have a Western neo-animist world that one could say seems pretty unguarded. Unguarded in how it treats ritual space, how it treats individual journeying, how it casually steps into potentially life-shattering plant medicine journeys with total strangers. Because what could go wrong, right? Everything from how we casually approach the sacred to how we post about it constantly seems, let's just say, unguarded. We've opted in many ways for an it's all good vision of animism and of nature, which is simply not congruent with traditional visions in which great care, hours of practice, hours of adornment, slow, deliberate acquisition of spirit help are the heart of the interaction with the animate world. To enter the ritual space, the trance space in traditional animisms, is to enter into a precarious place, an in-between place. And in this place, great care is given. So traditional ritual spaces, for example, are meticulously rid of anything that doesn't need to be there. Foundations are established. Perimeters are cleared. Things that need to stay outdoors are fed outdoors or politely invited to leave. Things that you want in the space are invited in. In some traditions, certain drum rhythms set the space. In others, certain verbal invocations. There's almost always a sonic element to establishing space. Sometimes the establishing of the space takes a whole lot longer than the actual ritual itself. I'm going to do a whole episode on guardianship and traditional animisms, so I won't get too deep into it now. But let's just say that adornments, and here I'm talking about internal adornments gained through practice, adornments are guardianship. They serve to repel what needs to be repelled and to attract what needs to be attracted. And so there's that tantric vision again, absorption and reflection, the two phases of universal vibration. Adornments attract and repel, which harkens all the way back to that primal power of horns. So adornments are gatekeepers, gateways. They determine what we take on versus what we repel, or you could say what we say yes to and what we say no to. For to be adorned with the ability to say no when we need to say no is a powerful adornment indeed. The very first talisman, one could say. The very first talisman. To precisely and specifically say, no, I'm not open to everything, is one of the first foundations of animist practice. So, of what are your adornments? Are they helping keep you safe in the storm? A good blanket. Now, that is a worthwhile adornment. A good psychic blanket, you know, a good mantle, a good veil. Of what are your adornments? For your adornments are the fat and salt of the soup of your life. The adornments are what make the whole dish worthwhile. Those ancestral recipes for pies and tarts, those are adornments. There's power in there. There is a special Romani bread, it is said, in which each dash of salt and each pinch of yeast is a protection from curses. And the bread is baked and broken and eaten, and those blessings are ingested whole. Of what are your adornments? Are they of trusted friends, of stories told by fires? Of what are your adornments? Are they of slow and patient study? Are they pearls of sweat generated by hours and hours on ritual dance floors? O children of Adam, says the Quran, you have been given clothing, both for protection and adornment. However, the best adornment of all is God consciousness. And if the words God consciousness aren't necessarily your jam, consider it differently. The best adornment is to be awake, aware, aligned, astute, in awe, in reverence, absorbing what we need to absorb, reflecting back what we need to reflect. For there is a place within heightened consciousness found through repetition. The same repetition as the stringing of beads, the uttering of mantras, the cracking of eggs, the weaving of cloth, the singing of songs. There is a place where to be awake to the world and well-guarded and in full aesthetic expression are the same thing. To be a jewel that reflects light and that allows light to pass right through it are the same thing. To be the salt of the earth, the light reflecting off the sea.
O que é que a baiana tem? Que é que a baiana tem?
This classic Brazilian song by Dorival Caymmi speaks of the use of adornments in the Afro-Brazilian traditions in Bahia. It lists the adornments of the baiana one by one. What does the baiana have, the song asks? The torso, the silk headcloth? Yes, she does. Golden earrings? Yes, she does. Golden chain? Yes, she does. Pano da Costa? That's like a rib piece. Her back like a corset? Yes, she does. Golden wristband? Yes, she does. A golden rosary with a big ball like this? Yes, she does. Slung across her body, the baiana carries a jingling array of balangandans, talismans, tokens, a melon for longevity, a fist to drive away illness and envy, a pomegranate for fertility, the moon and the bow and arrow for Oshosi, the orisha of the hunt and of forests, an axe for Xangô, god of lightning, fire, and justice, a fish for Yemanjá, goddess of the sea waters, a coin for prosperity, a key for freedom, a sea turtle, a chimney sweep, a bunch of grapes, drums, barrels of agates, alligator teeth, balangandans. These adornments of the baiana are both defensive and attractive. Iemanjá, the queen of the sea in the Orisha traditions, is adorned in a mirror and a veil, expressing the absorptive and reflective capacity of the ocean and the ocean of consciousness itself, the defense and heightened sensitivity at once. As in the tantric vision, the sound, the brilliance of the ornaments serves to repel what doesn't need to be there and attract what does. Quote, the term balangandan may have a Bantu origin. Researchers seem to agree that the term's onomatopoetic characteristic came from the perception of the sound the jewelry makes from the swaying of women's walks when they have them wrapped around their waists. Balangandan, balangandan, balangandan. So the sway and the clang and the shine of the ornaments attract and repel. The brilliance and the sound scatter unwanted energies, attract others. So vital is it to be adorned in this way, the song tells us, that quem não tem balangandans não vai ao bom fim. If you don't have ornaments, you don't get to meet the Lord of good endings, the divine.
Um rosário de ouro, uma bolota sim. Quem não tem balangandã, não vai no bom fim.
Olho vai no bom fim, olho vai no bom fim.
Um rosário de ouro, uma bolota sim. Quem não
That's how central adornment is. Adornment is life. To be adorned is to be human. The very first human beings, said the ancient Greeks, were adorned. Pandora, the first woman, is molded by the maker Hephaestus, and adorned by Athena, who, quote, adorns her with silver clothing, an intelligent veil, garlands of flowers, and a crown made by Hephaestus. This is the first characteristic of Pandora, adornment. The first characteristic of the first ancestor in this vision is adornment. So Pandora is not simply the one who let all the trouble out of the box. She is the intricacy and paradox and complexity of an ornamented world. And within this, she exists as humans always have, ornamented in the paradox of multiplicity, ornamented in chaos, ornamented in hope. To be adorned is to be human. For what other way would there be to meet this world than adorned? In a vast, wide world, why put on the robe and ring the bell? Asks one Zen koan. Why do rituals? Why dress a certain way? Why repeat certain things? Why wear that talisman at the heart? Why repeat the mantra over and over again? It's about finding patterns to align to. Ritual adornment is exactly how we make patterns out of what can seem to be chaos. How we find alignment to the larger pattern of nature, the larger pattern of creation. Adornment is the mandala of pattern, of identity, of ritual, of culture. The ancient Chinese word for culture, David Hinton tells us, wen, refers to a design, a pattern appearing upon a surface, veins on a rock, ripples in water. Pattern is culture. Writer Subhamoy Das quotes the ancient Sanskrit grammarian Panini as saying that the samskaras, which in this context refers to the Hindu rites of passage, are the ornaments that decorate one's personality. And of course, for those who have studied Buddhism, samskaras also refers to karmic patterns and impressions. So ritual reflects and creates a pattern. And in traditional Hinduism, there are 16 such rituals that are the protective adornments of life. A ritual marking conception, marking 3 months in the womb, marking the last month in the womb, marking the child's birth, and then its naming, marking the four-month point when the child meets sunlight for the first time, marking at 6 months the first taking of solid food, and then the child's first haircut, and then the piercing of the ears, and then the receiving of the sacred thread, and then the beginning of study, and then a whole other ritual for the beginning of Vedic study, and then the wedding ritual, and then the fire ritual, and then a ritual marking the beginning of the couple's life together, and then finally the death ritual, the ritual of passage. And of course, there are pitfalls to hyper-ritualism too, which we'll explore. But for this moment, simply feel into this. How would your life be different if there were a ritual to mark every step of it? And the whole community were there every step of the way, singing. How would it change things to carry with you a rosary of ritual adornments? These mandalas of habitually architected pattern, these adornments that bind the individual to the community to the ecology, to the greater cosmos, these are important. For how would we face the vastness, the impersonal vastness of this world, unadorned? How would we face the grief of this modern world, unadorned? How many today are left to confront the abyss of existence, bearing no sacred patterns, no sacred talismans, no songs, no community, no help, nothing. Nothing but the weight of their own psychology. The vast, wide world is navigated through adornment, through ritual communal patterning, through what has commonly been called spirit help. If the myths tell us something, it's that spirit help is vital. It's vital to be adorned. For how else to survive those underworld journeys, those labyrinths? How else? You may have heard the story of Inanna, Queen of Heaven. Inanna, who descended to the underworld and rose again as the morning star. Inanna, the great goddess herself, adorned. You know the story, perhaps, of how Inanna turned her ear towards the underworld. She turned her ear towards the underworld and she determined to give up everything. Her office, her station, her prestige, her influence in the upper world. She gave up everything to descend into the very depths of the underworld, where her sister, Ereshkigal, was queen. So how did Inanna prepare for her underworld journey? She adorned. She clad herself in 7 royal ornaments, 7 divine powers, a crown, mascara, a necklace, a chest piece, rings, wands, quote, gorgeously made up, with earrings, necklaces, bracelets, rings, corset, and cloak, all spiritual powers meant to ward off attack, Inanna set forth. She descended into the underworld. She came to 7 gates whose bars were thick with dust. At each gate, she had to surrender one of her ornaments, her powers. So at the first underworld gate, her crown is removed. First, of course, her crown. Have you ever been on those underworld journeys, those transformational journeys, and you're like, can't I just hang on to my crown at least? Yeah, no. The crown is what goes first. Her crown is removed. And in the original Sumerian telling, Inanna cries out, what is this? And the gatekeeper of the underworld responds, be satisfied, Inanna. A power of the underworld has now been fulfilled. Do not speak against the rituals of the underworld. So, layer by layer, gate by gate, she sheds her adornments. She sheds every last one. Inanna, the great goddess, arrives naked, unadorned, into the depths of the underworld. There is a ritual giving up, a ritual shedding that must occur. The underworld is where everything is taken, where everything accumulated is offered. But had she never been adorned at all, who knows if she ever would have made it past the first gate? Or she might still be in the underworld to this day, naked on a hook in the abyss. If she had never been adorned at all, what accumulations would she offer in the underworld? So the holy work in the upper world is to accumulate adornments. The holy work in the lower world is to let them go. Both are equally important. The adornments of Inanna are all of the constructs that allow us to navigate life, to navigate a world of forces, and they are absolutely necessary. To see her adornments as ego that needs to be shed, as identity that needs to be shed, is too simple. To say that the story is only about the shedding of constructs is too simple. The story is also about the importance of accumulating constructs. That's the cycle. That's the breath cycle. The oak tree's winter shedding depends on having something to shed, on the adornment of leaves, fruit, and acorns acquired in the spring and the summer. If the oak tree did not adorn in spring and summer, it would die in winter. If we try to plunge into the underworld, into the abyss of our lives, into the torrents of our own psychology, into the pain of environmental grief, if we try to plunge in totally unadorned, well, fragile, anxious, solitary minds may not survive. Both are necessary. The journey is always a mirror of the breath cycle, of the pulse between fullness and emptiness. The journey, the pulse of the journey, is both to accumulate and to shed. Here in the upper world, adornment is necessary. Rituals of joy are necessary. Bright colors and patterns are necessary. Songs of longing and exuberance are necessary. rosaries of ritual repetition are necessary. Friendships, loves, deep cultivated relationality with the animate world, all this is necessary. If the fairy tales are to be believed, spirit help, in the form of little balls of string, and family recipes for charmed bread, and dolls passed to us by our ancestors, and spindles and needles and bright, shiny things, are necessary. So listen into this again closely, because this is taking us into deeper territory. To say that the story of existence is only about the shedding of constructs is insufficient. It's only half the story. The full story is about accumulating constructs too. So yeah, there's a philosophical tension here, right? Between adorned and unadorned, between materialism and spirit, between life and death, accumulating and shedding, non-existence and existence, all that. Because there are traditions that have said it's all about the shedding. Flee from the trappings of existence, from that false shine, from that objectification, from that overdependence on empty ritual and superstitious charms and that lust for ephemeral gold. And of course, this is natural. In response to the superficialization of adornment, in response to a world obsessed with material trappings and baubles and trinkets and rings and coins, traditions arose, visions arose, of course, of the futility and indulgence of adornment. So in Buddhism, that word samskaras, the same word that refers to the rituals of passage that form the ornament of personality, in Buddhism, it means the karmic patterning that is to be gotten rid of, trauma patterning. Samskaras are to be burned away through practice. Eventually, all the trappings are to be gotten rid of, right? And you can say that this is a beautiful vision too, a vision of getting beneath it all, stripping it all away until we get to raw, essential simplicity of being. At the time of Jesus, spiritual practice had become, you could say, overly adorned. The Pharisees indulged in audaciously ornate rituals that had gotten away from the simple truth of nature. So Jesus came, how? Unadorned. Clad in a single, unadorned white garment. He was a carpenter who spoke in simple parables about the forces of nature and returned people to the simplicity of love and of breaking bread together. And there's something about that vision of pure, unadorned love. The simplicity of it makes space for something very potent to shine through. God is love. Simple. All else, perhaps, is unnecessary embellishment. In Tibetan Tantra, the primal beings Samantabhadra and Samantabhadri embrace naked with no adornments whatsoever. They embrace as raw consciousness. The primal ground of consciousness is repeatedly described in the Dzogchen traditions as naked, unadorned. The highest vision is unadorned. And this emphasis on lack of adornment is reflected in the monastic lifestyle, right? Monks withdraw from the trappings of the material world. Their heads are shaved. They carry only one robe and one bowl. They're only adornments. One robe, one bowl. Some do not even carry that. Nagababas go completely naked, clad only in the sky. There's allure there. Who hasn't wanted at one point or another to just give it all up? To be nobody going nowhere, to quote Thich Nhat Hanh. This dance of adorned and unadorned, this tension between nothing and everything, death and life, non-existence and existence, plays itself out across the centuries, across the world. In Indian tradition, it's a tension that goes back at least several thousand years, and it finds beautiful expression in the stories of Shiva and Parvati and their union. Parvati, on the one hand, adorned in life, adorned in gold and silks and dripping with jewels, the radiance and dynamism and birthing power of existence, red with blood, flushed with life. And Shiva, on the other hand, stoic, meditative, absorbed in void eternity, adorned in ashes and bones. Shiva's ornaments are described as horrible. As the wedding nears, the father of the bride is not pleased at all. This guy? Really? You're going for the one adorned in ashes and bones? In one Puranic tale, Lord Brahma visits Shiva before the wedding and basically says, look, these ashes and bones and snakes simply aren't going to cut it. He says, I know very well that this form you are presenting right now, in which you are adorned in time and ash and death, I know that this is actually your highest form. But you know that people are here for a wedding and you're going to scare them. Don't you want to put on something else? But Shiva, quote, politely rejects the festive wedding garments brought to him. Kind of a she has to love me for who I am type moment, right? And Parvati does love him for who he is. For what inspires more longing than one who has seen into the place where gold and jewels and ash and snakes and life and death and fullness and annihilation are one and the same? What is more metal than that? So Parvati sighs, quote, a god who wears snakes is far more wonderful than a god wearing ordinary jewels. And the wedding goes forward. Shiva wears, quote, a great bone for a diadem, dark blue serpents for bracelets, his elephant skin, ash, serpents, dreadlocks, and crescent moon served as the wedding ornaments. In one indigenous version of the story, he gives the goddess wedding gifts of death itself. Quote, at the wedding, Parvati asked Mahadeo, that's Shiva, what ornaments he had brought her. Mahadeo had gathered all the poisonous things in the world and made ornaments for her. Snakes, hornets, scorpions, toads, all of these become the non-dual wedding gifts. For what better gift for the great goddess herself than to be draped in all the poisons of the world? This world that is itself her adornment. This world of poison and medicine. This world in which she is the great wheel adorned in life and death. So she is garlanded in stinging scorpions and soothing aloe, in strangler fig and sweet elderflower, in brugmansia and lobelia and arnica, and in all last breaths and all newborns' cries. We do not fully understand her full cycle unless we understand that she is adorned in life and death. She is adorned in every opinion we like and in every opinion we don't. She is adorned in all opposites at once. And once we accept that she is the heart dance of everything that is, well, to reject her adornments altogether, that might be impossible. It's interesting, right? Monastic traditions and ascetic traditions remind us of the pitfalls of overemphasis on external adornment. And it's easy to view monastic traditions as unadorned, as having rejected all adornment. But in fact, the monastic traditions carry with them very powerful adornments. The adornments of community, of sangha, right? The adornments of codes of conduct that help prepare the consciousness for practice. The adornments accumulated by the Tibetan and Theravadan monks serve to create a ritual container within which they can find access to unadorned consciousness. They rely on adornment. It's not just them alone with their minds. It's them armored in mantra, in the rhythm of the practice schedule, in the simple food they eat, in the simple work they do. All of these are adornments. And here, somewhere, the goddess perhaps chuckles a bit at the monastic and says, you've tried to give up adornment, but even that robe is adornment. Even that bowl is an adornment. Try to reject this world of adornment, and all you ultimately will bring forth are deeper, more intricate adornments that live on my body alongside all the other adornments. For even the great philosophies of non-adornment are her adornments. Just as the Great Mother of the Universe wears the heads of atheists and nihilists and true believers side by side, in her great garland rosary of time and space, every meditative realization is one of her adornments. Imagine she wears a pearl garland of every state of samadhi realized by any sage that has ever lived. Even the full enlightenment of the Buddha, the great absolution of karmic patterning, even that which is supposed to be completely beyond the beyond, even full nirvana itself, even this is one of her adornments. For will extinction remain in the state of extinction forever? Will void remain as void forever? Once all karmic patterning has been absolved and resolved, will it remain free of ripples forever? Or instead, in the vast hollowness of deep space-time, in the rippleless infinity of nirvana, will she instead begin the dance all over again? And once again, her feet pound upon the void. And once again, her anklets start to ring. And once again, her adornments shake pattern universes into being. Infinite spirals of adornment ringing out forever. So, the reason I'm going into this ultimately it's all adornment topic so deeply is that I feel it can help us in the modern world navigate what you could call a fraught relationship with materiality, with energy, with animacy, with the goddess herself, with life, with pattern. Once we understand that in this vision there is no real abandoning of adornment, that it's all adornment, then it invites us to ask what our relationship with adornment actually is. On the one hand, right, you have modern Western adaptations of traditional spiritualities that reject adornment altogether. So all the bells and whistles get discarded, and along with the bells and whistles, all the flavor and depth and animacy gets discarded too. All the regular rituals and the careful feeding of the animate forces and the slow architecting of guardianship and the acquisition of spirit help, all that gets discarded, all of which in traditional context is extremely important. And then on the other hand, in this world of externals, in which the only way we are taught to value things is superficially, there's a proliferation of spiritual materialism in which only the outer adornment is seen to matter. Wear the right beads and the right yoga clothes, talk in the right yoga voice, Instagram yourself chanting on a clifftop, and that's spiritual, right? In such an externally focused world, outer adornment can overshadow inner adornment. All the emphasis and focus can go to what's on the outside. So there are teachers with all the right headgear and all the right beads. I'm sure you've met some of them. A few medicine songs and a few macaw feathers, and all of a sudden they're selling access to the timeless mysteries for $1,000 a cup. But I'm sure you know this. The crystal mala doesn't mean anything. The feathers don't mean anything. The stories we tell the world about ourselves don't mean anything unless they're aligned to something deeper. The image we project doesn't mean anything. The brands we drape ourselves in, the external body modifications, the shufflings of outer adornment, none of this means anything unless it's a reflection of something deeper within. The real question is, does the outer identity reflect something underneath? So, again, of what are our adornments? Are they reflections of years of slow, deliberate inner patterning, of years of inner work? Remember, the weaving of the Siberian shaman's garment takes time. Each knife, each mirror, each bell is placed there after the seer has undergone an ordeal. They earn the adornments one by one. And the outer adornments reflect a deeply cultivated inner world. So both sides of this polarity, adornments don't matter at all and need to be gotten rid of, or all that matters is external adornment, all that matters is external identity, relate directly to what you could call the loss of talismanic magic, which, as I'm using the term, is the ability to discern the precious and cultivate it, to discern the precious and cultivate it through repetitive patterning. In this era, it's neither enough to just rely on the quick fix of outer adornment or to reject adornment altogether in favor of some amorphous vision of consciousness. The forces around us these days are too strong. These days, we need those hard-won talismans, those balls of charmed string that are earned after years in service to a forest crone, those ancestral dolls, those ancient recipes for not untangling jam, those amulets that allow us to let go of what we need to let go of and keep what we need to keep. Inner adornment, you could say, is a consciousness fortified through rigorous practice. It's the defense against toxic discourse, against media brain. Meditative focus over time is a defense. Well-constructed imaginal geographies are a defense. For those stories, the Jicarilla Apache say, show us how to live right. To have familiarity with a spectrum of states of consciousness is a defense. To be able to distinguish inner adornment from outer illusion is a defense. In a world obsessed with flash and bling and shine, sometimes our ability to recognize inner adornment is compromised. How, in an Instagram world, a TikTok world, are we supposed to not conflate the immediate and shiny for the eternal and everlasting? But you know this, right? Sometimes the most elaborate outer forms are hollow inside, and sometimes the simplest outer forms conceal an inner adornment that is vast. So that one over there talks a good game, right? Has all the right beads and feathers. But when the traveling psychedelic caravan leaves town and they've taken half your paycheck and you're still trying to pick up the psychic pieces, they're nowhere to be found. Versus this one over here who doesn't look like much on the outside. No flash, no bells, no whistles. But if you knock on their door in need, they'll answer. There's a warm hearth inside. There's peace and rest. That is a profound adornment. To construct a house with a welcoming hearth and a soft bed for weary travelers, that is a profound adornment indeed. And there, bread is baked with just the right balance of salt and yeast. And some might come and receive such bread and stay a night or two. And some might leave the next morning, not even understanding what they'd received. How many such beds have I slept in? How many such hearths have I warmed myself by without even knowing it? Like Parsifal bargaining a night's sleep in a fisherman's shack with a stolen necklace, completely unaware that he's actually in the castle of the Holy Grail itself. Who knows? Perhaps all those years ago I stayed a night or two in the Grail Castle and didn't even know it, because I was too busy asking, what's next? Too busy Instagramming my own face. So many adornments I let slide, in the name of what I thought was freedom, or because, you know, I don't need that regular practice stuff, that's for everyone else. How many adornments squandered in favor of the wandering mind, out of kind of a youthful I don't give a f*** pride, or mistaking false lights for true lights, or simply not being able to detect what was right there before my eyes. It's true, I let magic lockets and precious stones and firebird feathers slip through my fingers, talismans that could have repelled some of the psychic crap of this life. All because I wasn't yet ready to recognize the precious when it arrived. It was only much later, much, much later, many underworld journeys later, that I began, perhaps, to understand what it would mean in my life to truly hold on to one talisman, one ornament. One song, one story, one psychic defense, one simple way of lighting fire. Talismanic magic. Do you get it? the ability to recognize and cultivate preciousness over time, the ability to cultivate inner adornment. So fine, so hidden, that inner adornment, so hard to recognize sometimes. If you look away for a moment, you might miss it. But when those who hold it smile, and we catch for a moment that spark in their eyes, then doors open, and they invite us into vast, articulated worlds, into layers and layers of shine. So, this year, may we recognize the luminosity of that which is precious, and adorn ourselves with it slowly over time, so that in a vast world we may walk, bearing sacred amulets and tokens and coins, bearing talismans drawn, glowing from life's fire, with an apron of bones and pearls that jingle in the forest, with a ball of charmed string, with pomegranates and coins and alligator teeth, with fish scales and whale tails, with Pandora's intelligent veil, bearing with us recipes for bread, bearing the holy patterns of song and story etched within. May we walk like this, adorned. May we walk with ears within our ears and eyes within our eyes. May we walk as little shining ornaments in the dark gray forest, walk adorned beneath the great spiral of milky lights. Walk adorned in the love of creation all these days and nights. Adorned, adorned in a universe adorned. So a few people to thank right here at the beginning. Sidi Bey, the singer who's been singing on a bunch of episodes recently, sang on this episode as well. So many thanks to Sidi Bey, and she has wonderful music that you can find on Spotify. It's Sidibe. Really happy to have some beautiful harp music composed for this episode. The harp music was composed by Andy Aquarius, and Andy Aquarius is on Spotify as well. You can find his music there. Nivedita Gunturi sang some beautiful slokas from the Bhagavad Gita and the Sundarya Lahari. Many thanks to Nivedita. Really happy to have gotten the chance to interview Staniswar Timalsina for this episode, and hoping to do maybe a more full-length interview with him. He's someone I've admired for many years and I continue to study with on an ongoing basis. And if you're interested in diving deeper into the tantric traditions, and I mean the tantric traditions as they really are, he is a wonderful person to study with, and his foundation is called the Vimarsha Foundation, V-I-M-A-R-S-H-A, and I highly recommend checking it out, and he offers free courses, which is just a real gift. Also wanted to give a quick thanks to Jackie Tileston for pointing me in the direction of the David Hinton book, Existence, A Story, and also the book, The Mediation of Ornament by Oleg Graybar. So thank you very much, Jackie. And Marina Alves pointed me in the direction of some of the Amazonian traditions and their views on adornment, which really helped bring texture and pattern to this episode as well. As always, this episode contains reference to many books, movies, songs, etc. These include the book Vajrayogini by Elizabeth English, Textiles of the Banjara by Charlotte Kwan, The Book of Symbols by Kathleen Martin, The Artful Universe by Bill Mahoney, The Harps That Once by Thorkild Jacobson, Shiva, The Erotic Ascetic by Wendy Doniger, Indo-European Poetry and Myth by M.L. West, The Chandipataha, Mother of the Universe by Lex Hickson, Tablet of Destinies by Roberto Colasso, The Sri Sundarya Lahari, translation by Swami Satyasangananda Saraswati, The Bhagavad Gita, translated by Winthrop Sargent, The Quran, Language of Images and Visualization in Hindu Practice by Staniswar Timalsina, I thank you, God, for Most This Amazing, a song by E.E. Cummings, Appearance of the Body and Beauty, Feminine Adornment by Isabel Perez Molina, writing for the Women's Research Center at the University of Barcelona, Personal Adornment and the Construction of Identity by Hannah Mattson, The Mediation of Ornament by Oleg Graybar, Milagros, Votive Offerings from the Americas by Martha Egan, Existence, a Story by David Hinton, Já me transformei, modos de circulação e transformação de pessoas e saberes entre os unicuin, Kashinawa, by Alice Haibara de Oliveira, writing for the University of São Paulo, The White Goddess by Robert Graves, Parsifal by Wolfram von Eschenbach, Shamanism Among the Peoples of Western and Eastern Siberia by Karina Solovyova, writing for the Russian Museum of Ethnography, the song Shiny by Jemaine Clement from the soundtrack of the 2016 film Moana, Conquistadors, a 2001 series from PBS, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, sung by Marilyn Monroe, the song O Que É Que a Baiana Tem by Dorival Caymmi, Renato Araújo da Silva's writings on Balangandãs, Bling Bling by Gucci Mane, All Gold Everything by Trinidad James, Uncut Gems, the 2019 film starring Adam Sandler and Julia Fox, and of course the song Shiny by Jemaine Clement from the soundtrack of the 2016 film Moana, a song which single-handedly confirmed for me the sheer amount of psychedelics that are currently present in Hollywood. If you liked what you heard today, please consider becoming a patron. You can find out more at patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. That's Patreon, patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. There are patronage levels starting for as low as $6 per month, and patrons get a variety of benefits that are listed on the site. I hope you enjoy today's episode, and until next time, may we live lives that are driven forth by imagination, vision, and wonder.